Wasn't it great to see all these babies up here today? It's a beautiful, beautiful sight. I want to speak, if I can find it here. Anybody know where Genesis is? I want to speak to mothers today, and maybe even more specifically, I want to speak to single mothers today. And then perhaps maybe a little more broadly, I want to speak to parents, and then maybe even more broadly to speak to everybody. But I want to try to speak specifically and maybe speak more broadly, but focus in on the specifics of the text here in Genesis chapter 21. It's an interesting passage in Genesis chapter 21 that is of great importance even today, because the struggle in the Middle East between the Arabs and the Jews dates all the way back to Genesis chapter 21. And so this is a very contemporary passage that I'm about to read that has implications even on the news as we watch it today. Embedded in this drama, and by there's a lot of drama here, is a single mother and her child. And what happens with her and her child is of great importance to her, to the world in her time, but even more importantly, even to the world in which you and I live. Now, it's important to know the backstory of Genesis chapter 21. And the backstory is really in Genesis chapter 16. Genesis 21 is really the continuation of Genesis chapter 16. In that chapter, a man named Abraham, who is perhaps maybe the most important figure in the Old Testament, because he is seen as the father of at least two religions, the Jewish religion and the Islamic religion, would see Abraham as their father. And to some degree, perhaps even the Christians would see him as, in one way, the father of our worshiping community, because you remember in the New Testament, the primary question is, what does it mean to be a true child of Abraham? Is it in the flesh? Is it in the genetics? Or is it in the faith? And I believe Paul was saying it's not in the genetics, it's following the faith of Abraham. And so here is this monumental figure, oftentimes called the father of the faithful. And he's 85 years old, and he has no children. The promise has been to him and to his seed, and he has no seed. So he's married to Sarai, who's 75 years old. Time is moving on, and he's worried. That was a crisis of faith. All the promises that God has given them are predicated on him having a child. He has no child. So Sarai comes to him and says, well, listen, maybe the promise is to you, maybe it's not to me. And so what I think you ought to do is to take my handmaid Hagar and have a child with her. Right there, you know, Sarai wasn't from East Tennessee. She wasn't from Greene County. Because no Greene County woman's going to tell her husband, just go have a baby with somebody else. I don't care. Go do it. And so Abraham amazingly says, I'll do it without discussion. So you know right there, he might have been from Greene County. Because she wasn't, but he might have been. And so in this relationship between Abraham and Hagar, a child is conceived, a child is born. Now, in our day, we look at that and say, why would God allow Abraham to have this polygamous relationship? He's a righteous man. What's this about? And I don't think you can probably defend polygamy, although it might be helpful to try to understand the situation in which they lived. One of the situations in which they lived, at least later on when the kings are reigning, is women outnumbered men by a really large margin. And so it was either polygamy or it was large numbers of women not having any opportunity to have children. And I think even today, if you ask a woman, do you want to share a man? Or do you want to live single the rest of your life? I think that's a hard question, and a lot of women would say, well, maybe I'll find some joker to share. I don't know. So it wasn't this oppressive system like maybe is represented today, but there's something else to say about that, which is this. God's command or God's vision for marriage is one man, one woman for life. So while we look at polygamy and are appalled by polygamy, understand they break the first part of that, one man, one woman. But in our day, we tend to break the second part, which is for life. So you say, how could God use a man who was polygamous? An equivalent question is, how could God use a person who's been divorced? Because it's one man, one woman for life. And I'm thankful that he's a gracious God because he will use people who have been divorced. And so I don't know if that makes the situation any better, but God still used Abraham. His grace and mercy still went to him in this moment. But things don't work out well, and they never did with polygamy in the Old Testament. Every time a guy had more than one wife, he had trouble because he had more than one wife. And Abraham has trouble because 15 years after that event, lo and behold, Sarah, his wife, is now pregnant. And that's chapter 21. In verse 8, it says of this child that of Genesis 21, of this child that Sarah has conceived, now Isaac, it says, so the child grew and was weaned, and Abraham made a great feast on the same day that Isaac was weaned. So here's Ishmael. Ishmael is the son of Abraham and Hagar. 15 years later, so maybe Ishmael wasn't, that was 15 years ago, so maybe Ishmael was 14, plus however old Isaac was when he was weaned, maybe age 2 to 4, added on top of that. So Ishmael is now 16 to 19 years old. And verse 9 says of Sarah, and Sarah saw the son of Hagar, or Ishmael the Egyptian, whom she had borne to Abraham, scoffing. So here's Ishmael, for some reason, sitting there laughing at something that Isaac has done. And Sarah, the mother of Isaac, sees it, and she gets crazy in her head. She goes ballistic. And in verse 10 says, therefore she said to Abraham, cast out the bondwoman and her son. Throw them out. For the son of this bondwoman shall not be an heir with my son, namely with Isaac. And the matter was very displeasing in Abraham's sight because of his son. He's talking about Ishmael here. And God said to Abraham, do not let it be displeasing in your sight because of the lad or because of your bondwoman. Whatever Sarah has said to you, listen to her voice, for in Isaac your seed shall be called. Yet I will also make a nation of the son of the bondwoman, because he is your seed. So Abraham rose early in the morning, took bread and a skin of water, and put it on her shoulder. He gave it and the boy to Hagar, and sent her away. And then she departed and wandered in the wilderness of Beersheba. And the water in the skin was used up, and she placed the boy under one of the shrubs. And then she went and sat down across from him at a distance of about a bow shot. For she said to herself, let me not see the death of the boy. And so she sat opposite him and lifted her voice and wept. And God heard the voice of the lad. When the angel of God called to Hagar out of heaven and said to her, what ails you, Hagar? Fear not, for God has heard the voice of the lad where he is. Arise, lift up the lad and hold him with your hand, for I shall make him a great nation. And then the Lord opened her eyes, and she saw a well of water. And she went and filled the skin with water and gave the lad a drink. So God was with the lad, and he grew and dwelt in the wilderness, and became an archer. He dwelt in the wilderness of Paran, and his mother took a wife for him from the land of Egypt. Now, I just want to point out a few things because this is an amazing passage. There aren't that many passages in the Bible about single mothers. And at this point, and from what we can tell going forward, Hagar is now a single mother with this teenage son. And that's an amazing thing. It's an amazing thing because God had great favor on Hagar, although here for just a little bit, it doesn't look like his favor was resting on her. Actually, she was a person that God had tremendous care for. In fact, in Genesis chapter 16, verse 13, Hagar had gotten into an issue with Sarai and for a time had to leave the house. And when she had left the house, God said to her these words, or she says of God. She says, then she called the name of the Lord who spoke to her. So she's in a bad place, and God found her where she was at and came and spoke to her. And she says, you are the God who sees. In other words, in her situation, God came to her as this single mother, this woman who really isn't loved as she should be, this woman who's fallen in a difficult place to operate and live. And God came to her in a critical moment of her life and said, Hagar, I see you. You're seen by me. Other people may not see you. Other people may not care about you. But I see you. I understand what you're feeling. I understand what you're going through. And then amazingly, she says, how I also hear seen him who sees me. And that's an amazing sentence because here it says, have I also here seen? The King James Version is more literal. It says, have I also here seen after him who sees me? And that's the force of the word. She says, have I seen after you? And Derek Kidner, one of the fabulous Old Testament scholars, says here that this can mean none other than that she sees the backside of God. You've seen after, seen behind him. It's the same words that Moses uses there on Mount Sinai, I believe, where he says to God, can I see you? And God says to him, you can't see me and live, but I'll put you in the cleft of the rock and I will pass by you and you can see behind me. You can see my back. You can see what comes after the front. You can see behind. And so Moses is there in the cleft and he's able to get a glimpse of God. And you say, wow, what an honor that he's able to see God and live. But understand, hundreds of years before, Hagar, this Egyptian girl that's not really loved or cared for, had the same opportunity to see the backside of God. She was seen by God and she saw God. So she's honored in that way. And so God is looking at her and saying, I understand. I see you. I care about you. It doesn't look like that. Maybe other people don't see you, but I care about you. So here in chapter 1, then he comes to her. And not only does he say then, I see you, but he says, I see your child too. And I want to talk to you about the child. In verse 17 and 18, he comes and says, Hagar, I see your child. And I want you to know, I have great plans for that child. And so that's who I want to talk to you about. Well, that's an amazing thing. Because when you think about Hagar here, she's in a bad mess. I mean, her marriage has broken up, if you can call it a marriage. Sarai cast her out. Nasty woman here. Cast her out. She doesn't know what she's going to do. She doesn't know how she's going to eat. Her life as it had been has come to an end. She has lots of questions. And God comes to her and says, essentially, I don't want to talk about your ex-husband. I don't want to talk to you about the nasty woman. I don't want to talk to you about where you're going to eat tomorrow. I don't want to talk to you about your career. I don't want to talk to you about all the hurt and pain you're going through right now. What's most important in this moment is what's going to happen to that boy of yours. I want to talk to you about your children. Now, that's a word in season for somebody. Because maybe you are a single mother today and you've got children. And maybe you're praying and you're saying, Lord, when are you going to send me somebody who looks like Tom Selleck when he was young? Lord, I want to talk to you about my love life. I want to talk to you about my career. I want to talk to you about educational opportunities. I want to talk to you about this rundown house. I want to talk to you about my brokenness and my heartache. I want to talk to you about that bum that threw me away. I want to talk to you about that. But God might be saying to you, let's talk to you about your kids. Your children are what's important right now. That's what's important. I came home from a minister's meeting last week. So I went to the minister's meeting May 1st and May 2nd. And I woke up on May 3rd, which happened to be my birthday. And I thought about my dad all day. Now, this is what I was thinking about. And I don't know if God has put this on my heart. It's a conversation I'm still having with God. But I think he's trying to say something to me. When my dad was in his middle years, he was part of a fellowship of pastors. And in 1987, the sort of de facto head of the fellowship that he was a part of passed away. And the fellowship just went into a split. And up to that point, Dad had pastored and would go to 3 or 4 camp meetings a year. We never got vacations as a kid. We were always going to some religious meeting. And so we went to these camp meetings, these conferences, and then Dad would preach 4 or 6 revivals a year. And so that was his life. We were gone. He was out of town maybe 9-10 weeks a year doing ministry stuff. And in 1987, that all sort of came to an end. And as the ministers were trying to figure out which side they were going to be on, which side of the split are they going to go in, Dad just basically threw up his hands and said, blast y'all. And he said, I'm going to go home, and I'm going to pastor my church, and I'm going to raise my children. It was a turning point in his life. I only say that because in 1987, and this was my thought, my dad was 45. I just turned 45. So that was the thinking. And it seemed like as I'm leaving this minister's meeting, and I have some involvement in the wider church, not much, but some, I don't know if God was trying to say to me, you're 45, it's time for you to go home and pastor your church and raise your kids. Now, I don't know if he wants me to have any involvement outside of Greenville. I don't know what that means. But I know that my kids are infinitely more important than ministry ambition. And I was a great recipient of that decision of Dad's because for 20 years I got mentored by him. I don't know what that means for me. And I know Dad would say to me a lot during that time. He would say, son, your ministry will come to an end and you'll go home to your family. Make sure you have a family to go home to. Your children are more important than your career. They are. Listen, and I'm talking to mothers. It's okay not to achieve everything you wanted to in your career at the expense of being a mother. That's okay. If you work a job and it's not the job you could have. You don't make as much money as you could have, but you do it because you want to raise your children and be there. That's a good decision. That's not a bad decision. And in fact, you know, even in psychiatry, I don't think they say this. Let me take that back. Social people who study, maybe the smart people who study how the mind works, put it that way, point out that something happens as you get into your 40s. And that is, most of the fulfillment that you feel in your 40s will come from your family. There's something that begins to happen in most people, and that is in your 20s and 30s, it's great to climb the ladder. It's great to see how far you can go. It's great to achieve. But after 40, increasingly, you've got to find contentment from something other than a career, because the best careers get old. It's been there, done that. And if you mortgage what could come after 40 because you are so bent on a career and climbing the ladder, understand that the climbing of the ladder and the building of the career, you've mortgaged happiness on the back part of your life. You're not going to have fun sitting in a house when you're 65, and it might be a pretty house, but it's not going to be fun sitting there all by yourself with kids that are a long way away. It's not going to be fun getting to see them every other Christmas and getting a Mother's Day card. And if your career is so important that you live the life that's going to bring that into existence, you've made a bad decision. God is looking at us and saying, I think, through Hagar to us, and again, I'm having this conversation with him because I don't know fully what it means. I think he's calling me to do something that I'm not doing now, and to weed out some things in my life to make more room for my family. I think that's what happened when I woke up on my 45th birthday. But he's calling, I think, everybody in some way or another to put their children first. Again, he's saying to Hagar, you got all this stuff going on. I understand the hurt. I understand the brokenness. Maybe he's saying that. I get what happened. I get all the stuff that happened in your past. I get that you don't know what's happening. But the most important thing right now is your son. So then he says to her out of that, so I want you to do three things. First of all, verse 18, arise, get up, get up, get up, get up, get up. Get up out of that grave. How did Miranda Lambert put it? How would Sister Lambert put it? Go and fix your makeup. Sister, ain't nothing but a breakup, something like that. Get up. Get up, girl. It's nothing but a brave. Get up. Why are you laying here? You've got work to do. You're acting like your life is over. You're acting like your life has come to an end. But you've got work to do. You got to get up. You got to do something. There's a kid over there. You can't lay in bed all day. You can't sit here and act like your life is over because he doesn't want you anymore. It's not about you. Get up. That's true. I mean, again, this is another example, yet another example in Scripture where somebody doesn't understand the monumental moment that they're living in. And remember Job, and Job says, well, I'm just going to, or his wife said, why don't you just curse God and die? Nobody sees, the kids are all gone, your friends don't like you, or they're not very good friends. All she can see is it's me and you and three low-down friends. Everything of value is gone. And, of course, what she doesn't see and what Job doesn't see is that all of heaven and all of the demons are sitting there in an audience which he cannot see, gambling, wondering what he's going to do. It was of a monumental nature that he was living in, beyond what he could see, beyond the footlights of his life. All the universe was wondering if he would curse God and die. And here's Hagar. I mean, this son will be the father of the Arab people. This son is going to have billions of children, or his lineage will be billions. And she's tasked with raising him. This is one of the 10 or 15 most important people to ever live, if you look at it in that way. But she doesn't realize that. She's willing to just lay down and die. You don't know what you're raising either. You don't know what you're raising. If you do it well, you might raise somebody who changes the world for the good. If you do it really poorly, you might raise somebody who changes the world for the bad. You don't know who you're raising. You don't understand the monumental nature. You can't look into the future and see how important this is going to be, but it's going to be important to a lot of people. And that person you're raising is going to grow up and probably marry somebody and have other kids and other kids and other kids. You're at the forefront of a generational issue. Don't give them a generational curse. Give them a generational blessing. So here he says to her, arise, arise. And then he says to her, not only arise, but take him up, or lift up the lad. Lift up the lad. Now again, you can say, well, if you didn't know the age, you would say, well, she's saying pick him up. But he's got to be 16 to 19. So there's got to be an emotional or spiritual aspect to that. Because I don't think she can pick him up. She's a stout woman if she can. And so what he's saying to her is lift him up. I mean, you got all your stuff going on. Your despair. You're thinking about dying. But what do you think's happening to the kid? Do something about the kid. And that's something that people need to hear, particularly if, God forbid, you're coming out of marriages and there's been a divorce. I know it hurts you. But think about what it's doing to your kids. Lift up your kids. Your relationship has come to an end, but their world has come to an end. What are you doing 6 months after the divorce trying to find some other sugar daddy? What about your kids? Fathers, what about your kids? What about your kids? Can you only see your hurt and pain, and she said that to me, and she hurt my feelings, and if she's going to do that, I'm not going to send her no alimony. It's your bloody kid. It's not about you. It's not about you. Lift up your kid. If you're single, quit telling your kid what a dirty, rotten mother or dad they had. It's not about you. Quit complaining. Quit trying to... Listen. It's not about your career anymore. It's not about your career. It's not about your hurt. It's not about your pain. It's not about you finding some other love in your life. It's about your kid. Lift them up. Tell them it's going to be okay. Tell them you care about them. Tell them you love them. Tell them that you're safe here, that it's going to be okay, that I'm going to be with you. Tell them God has a plan for them. Tell them that the future looks good, although the present may not look so hot. Tell them God has a plan for them. Lift them up. And the Bible says here, or God says to her, to the angel, get up, lift them up, and hold them up. Hold him up. And again, hold here looks like maybe a physical thing of holding them. But in the Hebrew language, it literally means strengthen. It's like when Moses had his hands up and they came and they held his hands up. They gave him strength. So he says, strengthen him. Make him strong. And man, that's good psychology. Because the great task of parents is not to protect your kids, but to strengthen your kids. I mean, you do protect them to the degree that you can. but you know that you can't ultimately protect them at some point. They're going out into the world. They're going off to college. They're going to school. I mean, you can say, I'm going to protect them, but you're limited in how much you can actually protect them in the end. So the goal is to strengthen them, to make them strong, not to protect them from the difficulties of life. Those difficulties are coming, and there's nothing that we can do about it. The question is whether their life will be built on a rock or on a sandbar. So he says, listen, here's your son. Encourage him. Everything inside of you feels broken and disturbed. Everything inside of you says, I'm going to lay here and die. There's nothing left in me. I'm completely drained. I'm completely empty. The Word of God comes to her and says, I see you. I see you, Hagar. Remember me, I'm the one who not only saw you, I'm the one who let you see him. Now, Hagar, get up. Get up. It's not about your stuff. Go over there and lift him up. Encourage him. All you can see is your pain. You can't see his pain. He's hurting as bad or worse than you are. Go encourage him. And as you're lifting him up, hold him up. Start to speak strength into him. Teach him how to be strong. Teach him how to be courageous. This is your job now, Hagar. It's interesting as she gets up and she, we presume, obeys the command of God. It says she looks and there is a well right there in front of her. It's like God is saying, in your desert place, here's water. Here's water. See, I'm going to take care of you, Hagar. You're sitting there thinking you're going to thirst to death, and I can just put a well right there. Look, there's a well right there. I'm going to take care of you. I'm going to take care of him too. And God will take care of you. Maybe you're single today, and he ain't sending no alimony. He ain't sending no child support. God can take care of you. God can take care of you. Arise. Lift him up. Hold her up. Lift them up. Maybe you're not a parent here today and you say, I'm not living in where Hagar's at, but I can sympathize because I feel like I'm in a desert place. I mean, it's not because of what a guy did to me or a woman did to me, but I feel like I'm laying here and I could die. I'm drained. I'm empty. It's the same promise, man. It's the same principle. Get up. Get up. Get up. Quit thinking just about yourself. Get up. Go help somebody. And there can be living water that opens up in your life. There's living water that flows from the throne of grace. There's hope for you. There's water in the desert. If you're there, if you're looking for it, if God is with you, you'll be okay. So today, I don't know. I came to encourage mothers. I don't know that I encourage anybody today. Mothers, you're doing a good job. Stand with me. You're doing a good job.